Okay, so as Alyssa mentioned at the beginning, I'm Professor Shauna Van Praag. I'm at the Faculty of Law, and I don't have a PowerPoint. I'm going to actually talk to you in a way that you might expect from a law professor on one hand, and in a way that you might find surprising from a law professor on the other. So I'm going to move from a very brief and superficial little information lecture about what tort law is, because we see a lot about tort, and I'm going in the discussion about cyberbullying, and I'm going to focus on the recent Nova Scotia Act to address and prevent cyberbullying and its legislated creation of a tort. I'm going to talk about what that means to create a tort, what that is, so kind of architecture of tort making, tort 101. This is not like the dessert, right? And then I'm going to accept the critique of law's place and law's potential, law's role, law's responsibilities, not by stepping back and saying there should be less law, more in terms of education, etc., but rather by saying there should be more law, but law differently understood. That in fact we need to perhaps go back to law school for all of the people who are so confidently legislating out there and rethink what the very foundations of law are and where we find law and what we expect of it. Okay, so I'm going to start kind of micro with a few selected little bits and sections from the recent Nova Scotia legislation, an act to address and prevent cyberbullying. In doing that, I'll talk about tort, and then I'll step back a little bit more broadly to law itself. Okay, so in the Act starts off in the way that any piece of legislation does. It says, this Act has a name, but you're not going to call it that name. We're going to call it something else. So the Act is called an Act to Address and Prevent Cyberbullying, but it's going to be cited as a Cyber Safety Act. So already interesting, right? It's about safety. It then goes on to give us a purpose. Why? Because we know that in law that when we interpret a piece of legislation, we always have to refer back to the purpose. The purpose is to provide safer communities. That's a very ambitious objective. By creating administrative and court processes that can be used to address and prevent cyberbullying. So a very broad, ambitious objective, safer communities in general. But then a very, very precise way of doing this, that is to create administrative and court processes. I'm not going to talk about a lot of the stuff on protection orders and the criminal law aspects of this Act. I'm just going to pull out a little bit from the definition section and then this piece, as I promised earlier, about creating a tort. So the next part that always comes after the title of an act and then the purpose of the act is the definition section. What do the words mean? We need to know right away what do we mean by cyberbullying. And the act tells us, and for those of you who have looked at it or heard about it, it's a very, very broad definition. Right? It means any electronic communication through the use of technology, including without limiting the generality of the foregoing. We actually do teach our law students not to write like this. I don't know what happens once they graduate. Computers, other electronic devices, social networks, text messaging, instant messaging, websites, electronic mail, typically repeated or with continuing effect that is intended, so here's the intent part, which I think ties nicely to Victoria's presentation, or ought reasonably be expected to cause. Right? So there's an interesting assumption that the people doing this can actually or are expected to be reasonable in their understanding about the potential risk to cause fear, intimidation, humiliation, distress, or other damage or harm to another person's health, emotional well-being, self-esteem, or reputation, and includes assisting or encouraging such communication in any way. It's very broad. Often, and this is what many of my colleagues in law have done in seeing this, they look at that definition and they just stop reading. They literally throw this out the window. This is too broad. It's too vague. Whatever the objective is, this is going to end up being very problematic in its application. That's not going to be the critique I'm going to focus on today, but I just wanted to underscore that definition and how broad that is, and how it both captures intent to cause harm, but also reasonable expectation of the causation of harm, and then gives a very, very broad spectrum of what it might mean to be harmed or to feel harmed, right? Okay, so I'm going to leave that for a moment. I'll come back to another piece of the definition of cyberbullying in a moment. Now I want to just talk about what the Act thinks it's doing or hasn't thought about what it's doing when, in Part 2, under liability for cyberbullying being what I just talked to you about, right, Section 21 of the Act, a person who subjects another person to cyberbullying commits a tort against that person. Okay, so, right, what's tort law? Well, tort is part of the private law of obligations in any legal tradition that does indeed govern the interaction between human beings. It's all about relations and relationships between one person who does something in a way that harms or affects the interests of another person. So we have that, a person who subjects another person. That's a core piece of what we're talking about in private law. How is that different than what we mean by public law? Well, criminal law is a good example of public law. It's the Crown that comes and says to you, you have done something that is against the Criminal Code of Canada. That's all in the realm of public law. It's not about the victim having to bring the case against the aggressor. When we're talking about liability, that is responsibility in the private law, to accept kind of accountability for what has happened and then to repair, and the only way we know how to repair in private law in the two major Western legal traditions of common law and civil law, which are found in this country, are to pay money. That's how we repair. There are other ways to repair in human civilization and in other legal traditions. That's the way we do it in private law, in tort law. Tort, of course, is the French word tort, right? Wrongs, civil wrongs, right? When one person has done something wrong to another, the way in which the private law enforces the obligation that was breached is to ask that person to repair through compensation. That's money. And, of course, the Act understands that and goes on and talks about how the court may award damages to the plaintiff, and in doing so, take into account things like particular vulnerabilities of the plaintiff. That actually doesn't tell us whether the damages go up or down. All aspects of the conduct of the defendant. That's weird in tort law. Usually when we calculate damages, it's all about understanding the injury or harm and the costs associated with that on the part of the plaintiff. We don't figure out the amount of damages, that is the compensation, based on the kind of conduct. The kind of conduct is the trigger for the obligation to repair. And then we figure out damages based on the level of injury suffered. And then goes on to say that damages will also depend on the nature of the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant. I think that this is probably getting at whether this is kind of a continuing relationship, how is this aggravated in that way. Okay, so very, very briefly, what does it mean to create a tort? First of all, as a tort law professor who's been teaching tort law for 20 years, I have never seen a piece of legislation that creates a tort. That is not how we understand tort law. Torts are particular boxes in English private law developed between the 1300s and the 1800s for different kinds of ways in which people can do something that harm the interests of another. So, for example, we have the tort of battery. That is non-consensual intentional touching. If I touch Victoria here and she doesn't kind of say either explicitly or implicitly that it's okay to touch her, I have committed the tort of battery. She doesn't actually have to be hurt at all. I have violated her interests. That's the tort of battery. If I am careless in my presentation and I am just telling you all kinds of stuff that is mistaken, I didn't do my homework properly and I'm not acting like a law professor should behave in getting up here and talking to you, and for some reason you rely on my words and you go and do something and that's ends up causing a harm to someone else, that's negligence. That's a different tort. That's the tort when I just am acting less than reasonably, carelessly, and through my actions, as a consequence, you are hurt. A different box. There are other boxes, tort of defamation, tort of nuisance. I'm not going to worry about all those different torts, except to say that none of them were created by a statute. The last time a tort was created in English tort law was in 1866 through a case. A particular case where somebody had water in a reservoir on their land, and through no fault of his own, the water escaped and flooded the neighboring land, and the case was called Rylands and Fletcher, and it created a very, very tiny little box called the tort of Rylands and Fletcher. And what it simply meant is that if that happens, something, I bring something onto my land, and without any wrongdoing, I act perfectly reasonably, but the water somehow escapes and affects the other person's land, I have to pay. And the principle was I act at my peril, right? I just take on that cost. That's the last time a tort kind of gained that kind of acceptance as a tort law, in the private law. Just 2 years ago, the Ontario Court of Appeal, actually, interestingly, we hadn't seen this ever in Canada, but the Court of Appeal created another new tort. We're not sure if it'll kind of take off in all the provinces across the country. It's the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. It's a privacy interest protecting tort. Comes out of a case, that's how torts are created, where somebody's banking information was kind of repeatedly looked at by someone within the bank. And nothing actually happened. No one stole any money. It was just looked at, and it turned out that the person looking at it was the victim's ex-husband's new partner. So she did not like that her information was being observed. That's it, right? No injury, no intent to harm her, to have any tangible loss, but that was a created tort. And as I say, we'll see what happens. So when the legislation creates a tort like that, or thinks that they're creating a tort, it's kind of strange, right, that they're thinking that they have the power to bring into the private law the law that has developed without statute, subject to statute. Statute can limit recourse to a particular tort, but statute doesn't create torts. But here, right, this sense, and here this is where I want to kind of just move into my concluding observations and critiques about this mistaken, I think, limiting idea of law. This idea that if we just could find some mechanism in law and we could create it, we could do something about cyber safety, right? We could have safer communities. What we need is stronger law. If we don't have the right box in tort law, let's make a box. And then one person can bring a claim against another. And that will have the impact of making sure that people say sorry to each other for the harm that they cause through compensation. We'll also send a deterrent message to people to be careful, because when you say something, it might harm another. We've heard about the ways in which those expectations about the message might be problematic or need modification when we're talking about young people. And this is my last piece of the act that I want to draw our attention to, and that is back in the definition section, right at the top of the act, after defining cyberbullying, the act goes on to say, for the purpose of this act, where it's a minor, a child doing the thing that we just talked about, and the parent knows of the activity, should expect, or reasonably should expect the activity to cause fear, intimidation, humiliation, distress. This is just repetitive, redundant, right? The very definition of the activity was that. And three, fails to take steps to prevent the activity from continuing. And here, as a parent of teenagers, I am honestly a little stumped here, right? The parent, and here we would expect the parent is responsible, right? Or is liable, or is presumed at fault for what the child has done. But no, the act says the parent engages in cyberbullying. That is cyberbullying. It is the tort. It imposes liability for the wrong on the parent. It's the parent's own wrong, own tort. That also, very strange in private law. Usually what we see in thinking about tricky problems of parents and children and what children can do that cause other people harm, and children can do lots of things that cause other people harm, sometimes we impose liability on the parent. Usually we presume fault on the part of the parent, and then we allow the parent to tell us a story. What kind of story? Well, the story that goes, I brought up my child well, I explained things well, he or she is well educated, and I am a reasonable supervisor of my child's activities. And then the parent is no longer liable, although the child might be. Okay, so, right, lots of interesting, unpackable, assumptions in the act, some vagueness, right, strange sense of power by these legislators to create something in private law, obviously with the intention of doing something that otherwise they feel helpless to do, that is to insist on bringing these two parties face to face in a way that they're not in the cyber world, but they will have to come face to face in the private law, and one will have to say sorry and pay damages. Okay, so one way to conclude this is to say, obviously, law is not the answer. You want safer communities. You can do some things with law. You really can't do everything with law. Education, you can do lots more with education. You can do lots in families. There are lots of ways in which we have to understand kids. We have to think about trusting kids. There's a very strange, and this is not original on my part, but a very strange distrust of youth that goes through this legislation. Right, this idea that the adults in the picture are controlling kids and will answer for what is going wrong. I think in counterpoint to what we've just heard about the possibilities of actually working with kids and listening to kids and watching them interact with each other and then tell us about the norms for that interaction. They don't just act. They actually usually understand what to do with each other, how to respond, how to say, I'm hurt, or you need to say sorry, or I'm going to get out of this situation, right? We need to pay attention to all of that. And in concluding in that way, right, it might sound that as a law professor, I'm saying, look, law itself can act like a bully. It can be very insensitive. It can actually be very crude in terms of its words, and it acts like a sledgehammer. But law can also, and I think this actually comes through interestingly in the legislation, can act very much like a victim. Real lack of self-confidence, desperation almost, in trying to come up with any kind of creative way we can find in law to send out messages. Instead, I want to suggest more law rather than less by saying that law is not only in the form of legislation, even in the form of private law or in a criminal code. What legal pluralism as a theoretical construct in law teaches us is that law is anywhere where human beings come together and work out in a normative way, right? That is, we should behave like this, or these should be the consequences, work out their interactions and the answers to those interactions together. So then in a very recently published piece, Harry Arthurs, past president of York University, law professor, writes that legal education could be understood as something that trains today's lawyers. We would probably say that's pretty limited. It could be understood as something that trains tomorrow's lawyers. I think that the people trying to be creative on cyberbullying through law think that that's what they're doing. Tomorrow's lawyers will have to deal with this new problem. But Harry Arthur says, in fact, legal education should itself, right, be an opportunity to rethink systems, processes, approaches, voices, and an invitation to look for law and its flexibility and potential in places other than legislative assemblies and courtrooms.